King Saul's son Jonathan had a son who was crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. His nurse picked him up and fled, and in her haste to flee, it happened that he fell and became lame. His name was Mephibosheth. And then from chapter 9. David asked, "Is there still anyone left of the house of Saul to whom I may show kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Now, there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and he was summoned to David. The king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "At your service." The king said, "Is there anyone remaining of the house of Saul to whom I may show the kindness of God?" Ziba said to the king, "There remains a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in his feet." The king said to him, "Where is he?" Ziba said to the king, "He is in the house of Machir, son of Amiel, at Lodabah." Then King David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, son of Amiel, at Lodabah. Brought to him Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, son of Saul. He came to David and fell on his face and did obeisance. David said, "Mephibosheth." He answered, "I am your servant." David said to him, "Do not be afraid, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan." David said to him, "Do not be afraid. I will restore to you all the land of your grandfather Saul, and you yourself shall eat at my table always." He did obeisance and said, "What is your servant that you should look upon a dead dog such as I?" And the king summoned Saul's servant Ziba and said to him, "All that belonged to Saul and to all his house I have given to your master's grandson. You and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him and shall bring in the produce so that your master's grandson may have food to eat. But your master's grandson Mephibosheth shall always eat at my table." Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, "According to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so your servant will do." Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. And Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah. And all who lived in Ziba's house became Mephibosheth's servants. The word of the Lord. I don't need to tell you, this is an astonishing story. For all of his swashbuckling exploits and his macho persona, David was capable of kindness. So here's the story. A lot has happened since we were together a week ago. King Saul and his son Jonathan were in a battle with the Philistines at Mount Gibeah. The battle did not go well. Jonathan and two of his brothers were killed in battle, and then King Saul also died in a questionable and dishonorable manner. On that terrible day, the news comes that Saul and Jonathan have died, and it seems Jonathan had a 5-year-old son named Mephibosheth. He was just a boy, tended by a palace servant, who scooped him up, began to run away and carry him to safety. But she stumbled, and the boy fell, and he broke his legs, or he broke his feet. We're not sure. The orthopedic surgeon is not able to give us a proper diagnosis. All we know is the little boy never walked again. And a nurse servant got him out of here. She hid him in a little town out in the middle of nowhere, and there he stayed while the nation continued on in some turmoil. You see, apparently Saul also had a fourth son that we never heard about until now, and he thought that with his father and his three brothers killed in the battlefield, that now maybe he should be the king. And he was endorsed by Abner, General Abner, who declared that this fourth son, Ish-bosheth, should be the new king. But I guess neither of them had been reading their Bibles, because if they had, they would have known that David already has been secretly anointed as the next king. Now, a couple of renegade soldiers knew this and proceeded to cut off the head of Ish-bosheth, thinking that David would approve of their action, but he did not. And that's all we'll say today about that. Suffice it to say, there was a lot of political maneuvering and military nonsense that went on for a while. It was like presidential transition 3,000 years ago. And the whole time, Mephibosheth is hunkering down in a little village that nobody can find. You see, this is the way it worked. When the new king would come to power, he would get rid of anybody related to the old king. There's no continuation of authority. The new broom sweeps clean, and in that day, it was usually a hatchet or a sword that did the sweeping. Brutal times. And maybe not so different from our own. I'll never forget when a few of us were having lunch in a small cafe in Port-au-Prince. It was on our first mission trip in Haiti. A well-dressed man walked in and sat two tables away from our group, and our guide froze. She looked terrified. After we paid the bill and left, she explained out in the alley that man had been the leader of the secret police for Papa Doc, a notorious dictator who had once run the country. And she said, "We should have gotten rid of him while we had the chance." You hear it? This was the way a transfer of power happened in ancient times. You eliminate anybody from the old palace. And David, the brand new king, asks, "Is there anybody still left from the house of Saul?" They find one of the old palace servants, a man named Ziba, who, as the story will later reveal, is not an honest fellow. For now, though, he bows before the new king because he knows where his bread is buttered. And then he rats on Mephibosheth. Tells him how to locate the young man in the town that nobody can find. So servants are dispatched, and Mephibosheth is brought to the palace. Imagine how he's feeling. The Philistines had it in for his father and his grandfather and his uncles, and they're still out there causing trouble somewhere. His other uncle had thought that maybe he should be the new king, but he was dispatched with rather quickly. And this new king, David, is not from his family. Now, at best, David has married one of his aunts, but by all accounts, that marriage is not going well. And in spite of it, David's power is growing. He has a larger and larger and larger than life reputation as he summons Mephibosheth to the palace. They bring him. He is unable to stand on his own, unable to walk, unable to run away. And maybe this young man knows that the king has already issued a decree in chapter 5. Nobody blind or lame shall ever be brought into the palace. That decree stares him in the face. David calls out his name, Mephibosheth. "Yes, sire." There's a long pause, and then David says, "Don't be afraid. From now on, you will eat at my table, and I will regard you as one of my own family." It is an unexpected move. The last thing Mephibosheth could ever imagine, because he knew where he and his family came from, and he knew what's usually done to the rulers of the last ruling party, and he had this disability. As one of the scholars says, the terms crippled in both feet implies four things in the ancient world: economic vulnerability, physical riskiness, permanent immobility, and religious alienation. That is, not only did the greater society think of him as marginal, but that somehow God in heaven had declared him expendable. Mephibosheth believes this. He calls himself a dead dog. Who am I that the king should look upon a dead dog as I? And that's the point at which the story turns. David knows who he is. This is the son of Jonathan, his dearest friend, and the son of Saul, the first king that God gave to the people. And David and Jonathan, as we heard, they were tight. They made a covenant to always love one another, the same covenant that David's great-great-grandma Ruth made to Naomi: your people shall be my people. Where you go, I will go. David knows who he is. He is the son of Jonathan, worthy of continuing kindness. And David knows something more. Mephibosheth is also a child of God, worthy of an even greater kindness. It's in the nuances of the story. David asks at first, is there anyone left in the house of Saul that I might show him kindness for Jonathan's sake? And then he goes on to ask again, is there anyone left in the house of Saul that I might show the kindness of God? That's what he says, the kindness of God. The Hebrew word here is chesed, usually translated loving kindness. It's continuing kindness. It's unearned covenantal kindness. Why, it's the closest thing in the Hebrew Bible to the New Testament word grace. So this is an enormous moment, if only because it is the only time in the Jewish Bible where the text speaks of the kindness of God. The kindness is shown not only to the grandson of the enemy, who is also the son of the friend. It is kindness shown to a man whose disability has made him vulnerable in the world, and therefore overlooked. I think we know the lesson here, without overdrawing it. But it is worthy of emphasis again with a remarkable story like this. Whom are we going to welcome? Really welcome? Those who are fit, those who are healthy, unblemished, those who are physically intact in some way, or do we welcome the rest of us, the real us, who may very well have some part of us who is unfit or unhealthy or a bit blemished, maybe with physical challenges? It would be enough to simply recount a few stories, and I have a few. Back in the early 90s, when we were planning to renovate this building, we met with architects who are capable and imaginative. A lot of meetings, a lot of plans, a lot of listening to the congregation. What do we need to do? What walls need to move? How do we move things around? Building task force was really capable. At one point, as we're looking over the blueprints, one of the architects says, now, you know, the church is exempt from having to follow the American with Disabilities Act, and that could save you some money. The task force looked at him, sized him up as well-intentioned, and then one of them said, we know we are not bound by a civil law to make this building more accessible to people with disabilities, but why wouldn't we? The opinion was unanimous. There had to be cuts in the curbs, doors and aisles wide enough for wheelchairs, with other small but critical decisions to make rooms like this available and accessible to all. Because how else could we show the kindness of God? So a few years after that, I had a friend who was the activities director of a local nursing home. We got to be quite friendly. I was going over once a month for communion services. She said, "Could I bring some residents to a Sunday morning service at your church?" I said, "Sure." We pulled out a pew back there somewhere so a few wheelchairs could get in, and she showed up with 8 people. No problem. We have resourceful Presbyterians. Another pew was taken out, didn't quite fit, another one, and everybody rolled in. And we had enough forethought to make some extra large print bulletins that day. We asked the organist that day to play extra loud. In a hospitable gesture, the deacons offered to prepare a nice dinner for our guests. Dietitians were consulted, tables were set, spaces prepared for the wheelchairs. Hosts and hostesses were deployed so that nobody would feel particularly singled out. After the benediction, we discovered the real challenge. How could we get 8 people in wheelchairs to the room downstairs? Because then there was no elevator. See, at the time, some of the prevailing voices said, "Well, there's nobody here who needs an elevator. We're not going to spend money on an elevator." Well, of course there was nobody here who needed an elevator, because the people who needed an elevator weren't going to bother with a building that they couldn't get around in. They stayed home. So despite all best intentions, 8 people in wheelchairs were here that morning, and we had tables set for them downstairs. And it was the second week of December. It was snowing. There was ice on the sidewalk. As we wheeled our guests out to the sidewalk on the hill in snow and ice, as we backed them down the hill to the lower level, there was one moment when 3 of our guests almost became Catholics. We can laugh at ourselves now, but there is nothing funny about welcoming Mephibosheth. The recurring question of every church, the recurring question of every decent human being, is how might we welcome those whom the world shuts out? Now, granted, kindness was not one of the most obvious character traits of David, Israel's favorite king. Goliath was not the beneficiary of Dave's large and generous heart. Neither were the 200 Philistines that he carved up to win the hand of his first wife in marriage. Neither, for that matter, as we'll hear next week, was his first wife highly respected. You see, David had this little problem about staying home. Yet, here in the scriptures is a thin slice of experience where Mephibosheth is welcomed and fed as one of his own, as one of God's own. Just like our own uneven experiences of welcoming those that the world pushes out or pushes away, there are occasional moments when we might get it right. And the vision is set before us. How would it be to truly welcome everybody in the name of God? 1,000 years after David, there comes a holy man, a healer who touched the untouchables and healed whatever he could. And this holy man, Jesus of Nazareth, had such an enormous heart that the people of his own time called him the Son of David. One day he's teaching, and he says, "When you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind, and you will be blessed." Now, I'd like to think he learned that message from great-great-grandpa David, but I think he probably learned it more completely from his Father in heaven. For such is the kingdom of God, a dominion where everybody experiences God's kindness. And there are no barriers, no boundaries, no stumbling blocks, physical or otherwise. In the meantime, we do have our saints remind us, if we're paying attention, to what the kindness of God looks like and how it would feel. So I think of the Reverend Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers. In the new documentary about his life and work, that clip we saw is there. He's chatting with Jeff Erlinger, a child in the wheelchair. There isn't a dry eye in the theater. And they were not tears of sympathy or pity. And no one in that moment dared to say, "There but for the grace of God go I." Oh no. Because we know that Fred could see what David could see. A child of God at his table. Grace is when you befriend a young man with profound disabilities and treat him as a child of God, because he is. All of us are. All of us.